Vino Ramonail, Heno Alenomas, Edeno Konona, Alenomas, Edeno Konona.
Shalom Aleichem. Rochim Abayim, welcome everyone, Bezdat Hashem. We're continuing our Shiurim in Sefer Mishneh Torah, the laws of Torah foundations of Rambam. I gave all the introductory stuff in our last lesson, so I'll reference you there for a historical perspective of our author, of the book. Here, we're discussing foundational concepts of what it is that we believe and what it is that we perceive to be, if you will, scientific truth and not just philosophical or religious doctrine. We're now going to discuss a very important issue. One of the foundations of our Jewish faith is summed up in a single verse in the Torah. One of the most famous verses known to almost every Jew and a tremendous number of non-Jews as well. We call it the Shema Yisrael, Deuteronomy 6:4. It states, in its most popular English form, how's that? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. An acceptable translation, even though I might be a little bit more meticulous, but you get the message. The ultimate statement of Torah is the concept of the unity of God, meaning that there's only one God. Now, here's where problems arise. We have known that for thousands of years, Jews have suffered under horrible Christian persecution, where Christians have threatened at the point of death Jews to accept their version of God. Jews, of course, fighting and saying, no, never, sooner die, and millions, of course, did. Christianity, of course, has the concept of a Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Now, I'm not here to discuss Christian theology and the origins of their doctrine of the Trinity, even though I might add that in its original format, it is something rather different than how it was codified and understood later at the Council of Nicaea in 325. And for those who have an interest in Christian history and theology, I'll let them do the homework. But in Torah, in Judaism, our proclamation has always been there's one God. Now, the nature of this unity is what Rambam is going to discuss now. And he will even express some ideas and concepts why this is important. But I want to begin, before I even discuss his words, to introduce to us what I believe might be a scientific concept. A concept we're familiar with, what we've known in science as the Big Bang. Everything in the universe came forth from a single point. And the concept of a singularity. Science and math is really interesting. I would encourage you to go online into online encyclopedias, the likes of a Wikipedia or something similar. Look up singularity and see all the different forms that it takes outside of social context, the name of rock and roll songs or any silly things like that, but in math and science. And read about what the word has been applied to and all strange and bizarre types of things. Ultimately, what our Torah teaches is that, as we learned in our previous lesson, when I endeavored to describe what, not who, but what is God, we refer to it again, as primordial existence, the ultimate fundamental foundation of all reality. And we are here in law number 7, where Rambam says, Eloha ze ehad hu, ve'enu shnaim, ve'lo yeter shnaim el ehad. That this God, he is one, right? He is not two, not more than two, right? And he's not kind of like he says here. I'm going to read the English translation. He's unified in a manner which surpasses any unity that's found in the world. Okay? Big deal. I ask. Big deal. From a point of view, I ask a question. What difference would it make if there's one God, two gods, three gods more, five gods, six gods, seven gods more? Who cares? What happens if there was a pantheon of gods, as it was in ancient Greece or in Norse mythology? Many of us are familiar with the ancient legends of Mount Olympus or Asgard. Many of us, of course, have heard of Hercules or Thor, both made popular in Marvel Comics, I might add. Is there any validity or reality to this? Possibly in ancient history there might have been something. Whether we could ascribe to that any type of divinity is something that would be argued, certainly discounted by us. But ultimately, what difference does it make? Here I am, as a human being, trying to live a normal, decent, good life. What difference would it make if there is one God in heaven or many gods in many heavens? So what? What does it have to do with me? What does it have to do with real life? And it might surprise you that aside from anything theologically or philosophically, this is actually a big deal. Because it describes to us, if you will, the fabric of the universe and the ultimate direction of existence. Think about this. Let's take a concept like the Chinese yin and yang, or the Christian concept based upon the Mithraic origins of good versus evil. In other words, some type of a duality. And each one, if you will, is duking it out with the other. Each one, if you will, is in a state of harmony or disharmony with the other. What does this do? Obviously and essentially, it creates an unstable environment, where in which the norm would be a constant tug of war, constant struggle. Fundamental differences and ideas and definitions of things like good and evil, right and wrong, would be in a constant state of flux. There would be no stability. There would be no continuity. And as such, anything that would be built would be destroyed. And that leads to chaos. When you have a singularity, where in which everything emanates from a singular source, then it emanates with, if you will, a singular purpose, a singular source. And however diverse a reality might emanate from the singularity, however complex, however apparently contradictory, however different, ultimately, everything is still connected to the singular source, and as such, guided by the singular source. And therefore, by definition, there is continuity, stability, direction, and purpose, even in apparent chaos or complexity. And this is a vital point in everything in existence. There's an old Masonic statement, order out of chaos. For those of you who have studied Kabbalistic teachings, I've discussed concepts of this nature in my Otzrot Chaim classes, or Kitu Ari, that prior to God, if you will, creating order, God created chaos. God created chaos? That's all right. That's exactly what he did. And the Pasuk And Isaiah clearly states, God created light and He created darkness. He created good and God created evil. Bore ra. Those are the words in Hebrew. Why? Well, you want to know something? Ultimately, they serve God's purpose. I received another email recently from an individual who questioned me with regards to a statement I made in a recent essay, how God's angels are watching over us, guiding all things. And the person, apparently from a Christian point of view, saying, well, if God's angels are watching all over us and allowing the scenarios that be to occur, what about Satan, the devil, and all of his demons? And I responded to him probably something that shocked him greatly, and I stated, they too are under the authority and direction of God. Not only do the angels take their marching orders from God, so does the Satan, so does everyone. Now, even this type of terminology which I'm using now, I emphasize, is only metaphorical. It's only symbolic. We should never think of God or any other type of entity in such a personified way that they are kind of like us. That is not divinity. When Rambam states here that the primordial existence is one, not two, not more than two, just one. And he writes here, and I read the Hebrew, She'in ke'yichudo ehad min ahadim nimtza'im be'olam. The matter of unity here is not like the concept of unity that we find here on earth. Lo achad kimin shehu kolel achadim harbe. It's not like there is one of a type which includes many others, if you will, kind of like a unity. Velo echad keguf, and not a singularity, if you will, like a body. Shehu nehalak lemahalakot ulekitzavot. A body, of course, as we know, subdivided into individual, unique, and separate parts. Ela yichud. Rather, there's just a singularity. Shein yichud acher kamoto ba'olam. There's nothing else like it in the universe. You know, in our previous lesson, I tried to describe what is God. I used a modern day metaphor taken out of modern day fictional presentations written by Mr. George Lucas in his famous movies, Star Wars. And he created a concept which he calls the Force. And even though his descriptions of the Force are by no means the way that we understand what we call the primordial existence, nonetheless, by not personifying it and calling it a person, but this nebulous energy, is probably one of the best understandings of God that I can describe to you. In the deeper secrets of our Kabbalah, God is clearly described to us in all different ways and symbolic means. However, we have a Hebrew term, l'shakech et ha'ozen, meaning all of these symbolic terms are only there to help us understand an otherwise abstract reality. Ultimately, there is a fundamental integration and unity. That it's not like many parts come together to form a whole, but rather there's just a single homogeneous it, from which come, out of which come, parts, out of which comes complexity, and indeed chaos, so that there could be order. Granted, you might very well want to ask, well, why did God do things like that? Well, We can go into discussions of theology and philosophy to answer those questions, and of course it could take us many, many lessons through many, many books. But I like to stay focused on the here and now and practical application of things. And therefore, in my mind, it is not my faith. Now, let me repeat that. It is not my faith. It is my knowledge, my experience, my awareness, my conviction that there is an ultimate singularity. And that anything and everything that happens, happens for a reason, is connected with other things. Even thoughts and processes going on inside our minds have a reflection and a connection in events and occurrences that happen in the world around us that we witness. And the psychology of Carl Jung, they call such a relationship synchronicity. A fancy word to describe a relationship. But in order for two parts to have some kind of a relationship, there must have been some common denominator, which obviously allowed them both to rise each in their individual worlds, one internal, one external, for the sake of referral to that which is in the center, the human soul. This is a singularity where everything has its connection here. This is my reality. I don't know how else to describe it. Rambam continues. He says, if there were many gods, right? He says, they would require gufin the giviot. They would require bodies and forms. He says, because how else could you separate from each other only through circumstances associated with bodies and form? I can separate between myself as a human being and another human being because obviously we're two different bodies. But yet in my mind, now, you can open up my skull and take out my brain. But you cannot open my brain and take out my mind. My mind is a nebulous abstract. Call it my soul, my neshama, whatever. Can't pick it up and show it to me in your hand. But yet, in my mind, I have many different thoughts. And each thought is clearly different and separate from the other. How is that possible? They do not have bodies. But my thoughts do have form. And as having form, they exist separately. Rambam's case here. How could you have many gods? By definition, just like I have multiple thoughts in my mind, if there were many gods, then you would each have to have each one within the context of a form, a body. Now, I understand Rambam's concept here. He continues and says, "V'ilu ha'yoser kufa gabiyah," because if the primordial existence had some type of body or form, then by definition, there would be both an end and a limitation. And therefore, it would be impossible to have a body or a form that is without limitation, because primordial existence, by definition, is above any type of form. That's why we call it in Kabbalistic language the Ein Sof, without end. We can say nothing of it. But now, here's an interesting little side point. Where in which the Rambam again states here, alright, if there were other gods, well, you want to know something? The Torah clearly states that there are other gods. We refer to them in the second portion of our Shema Yisrael prayer every day. The Bible in numerous places speaks of what we call the Elohim Achirim, the other gods. But a point that must be made here, that when Torah is speaking about these other Elohim, they are speaking about what we would call today angels. Because the primordial existence, what we call God, the Creator, has indeed set up what I call His civil service, wherein which He has His agents, representatives whose jobs it is to look after certain things, govern certain areas, and do what they've been instructed to do. These are called the gods, with a lowercase g. And they even have entities that work for them. We will find that as we go into the second chapter, where the Mishnah Torah, the law of the Torah foundation laws, we're going to enumerate the names of different angels. You'll find there's a group there called the Elohim, which are the gods, and then there's the Bnei Elohim, the sons of God. That is even referenced in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, where it says the Bnei Elohim, the sons of God, came down and took the daughters of men. And they gave birth to a race of giants. Man, doesn't that sound exactly like the ancient legends from the Olympian mythology and the Norse mythology? Could it possibly be that one of these sons of gods who came down and took the daughters of men, possibly, could that have included Zeus and one of the children, Hercules? The myth fits. Whether it's real or not, I couldn't tell you. But the myth is there. And it's an interesting correlation. Many of the nations of the world... No, let me rephrase myself. According to what our sages have taught us, each of the nations of the world have their own angelic representative who is in charge of pretty much what goes on in that country. These angels are given, if you will, their marching orders from heaven. They're told, this is what you do, this is how you do it. We learn all of this from the Bible, in the book of Daniel. If you remember, it was a very interesting story that Daniel lived in the Persian Empire at the time of the telling of the story, and he prayed to God for an answer to a prayer. And he prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. Finally, an angel comes to him and states, gee, sorry it took me so long, but the angel of Persia wouldn't allow me access. And I had to go back and get Michael, who's the head governor of the angels, to have a talk and blah, blah, blah. We went through this whole big problem. And you're scratching, like, what on earth is going on there? I thought God's in control. Why didn't the angel just say, be out of my way in the name of God? And as we see clearly, it just doesn't work like that. Nothing's changed. When we speak here of there being an absolute God without form and body, this is important that we do not recognize one of these lesser created entities and mistake it for being the ultimate source of power in the universe. That is not so. A point that was clearly made in the book of Daniel and interestingly referred to by Rabbi Avraham Azulai in his book Hesed L'Avraham, that these reigning angelic entities whose job it is to be over a body of people here on earth fight with one another all the time. Rabbi Azulai states they're like bucking rams who are always locking horns with one another. And I scratch my head and say, gee, I thought these guys, you know, these angels are supposed to be like these holy, you know, entities, little babies with wings on their back playing little harps. Why do they go around picking fights with one another? What is this, gang wars in heaven? That's what it sounds like. We might dismiss this as primitive mythology and say it's ridiculous. But judging from the nature of human conflicts, which are many times irrationally based, I'm led to conclude, my, maybe there really is something real to this, as opposed to just a story. Now, of course, from our Torah point of view, we accept it, but that's faith. I'm trying to transcend faith and go into reality and knowledge here. So the concept of a singularity, what we in Judaism find so vital, is to proclaim that ultimately everything has its one source. and all the conflicts, if they are not ordained by the one source, then are in opposition to the one source and should be neutralized. That it is not the nature of reality that we have inherent chaos, inherent instability, but ultimately stability. And that each and every entity in creation, call it a human being, call it one of the sons of God, call it one of the gods, call it an angel, I don't care. Ultimately, we are all created entities. And although there are entities which, if you will, ordained to govern over us, they are still nonetheless human beings. We stand here in the United States in a country where in which we vote upon our leaders. And every single leader that we would ever elect, however well protected, well educated, strong as that individual is still nonetheless a human being. And subject to all human frailties and laws like all the rest of us. Know then that each and every, if you will, God of the nations is similar in that respect. They might be as powerful as a president, prime minister, or king, but only within the context of their jurisdiction. We don't go messing with them. You're not going to send a message to the president of the United States thumbing your nose at him and his authority. You're not going to do that to an angel either. But it is equally insane to say, Mr. President, congratulations, you are the creator of the universe, you are the Lord God, we sit and obey you. Who talks like that? You sound like an idiot. But yet when people turn to angels, they do just this. Doesn't it sound equally idiotic? So, Rambam continues, and he states here, Eloheinu Baruch Hu, right? Eloheinu Baruch Shmo, our God, blessed be His name. Hoil, v'kocho ein lo ketz ve'ein posek, His power has no end and is completely constant. It never ends. Shehari Gilgil sovev tamid. Because existence, he calls it here the sphere, meaning the movement of stars, planets, we call the universe existence, right? It goes on. En kocho koch guf. And therefore, his body is not limited within the concept of what we call a body. Right? Behoil vein o guf. And he has, therefore, no body. Lo yeru lo m'orot ha-gufot kedei shehi nehalak u'nifrad me'acher. Right? He doesn't have a body, no circumstance associated with the body that makes divisions and separations or anything of the kind. Lefichach hi efshar shehi ele echad. It is, therefore, by logic, he states, only there can be one. And he states, v'idiyah d'varazay. Knowing this, he states, it's the fulfillment of the positive commandment that I quoted you from Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. God has no form, no semblance of a form, nothing of the kind. But now, here's something interesting. The next pasuk, Het, states, V'hari miforash b'Torah b'Nevi'im, it's written in the Torah and the prophets, She'en ha-Kadosh Baruch Hu guf ha-Gevi'ah, that the Holy One, blessed be, has no body or form, and he quotes here the pasuk, Deuteronomy 4:39, because God, the Lord your God, is the Lord in heavens above and the earth beneath. Right? How can he be in a body if he was in, you know, two places simultaneously? Quotes here Deuteronomy 4:15, for you did not see any image, meaning on Mount Sinai. Isaiah 40:25 states, to whom can like me, with whom will I am I equal? So if he were to be confined to a body, he would resemble other bodies. Logical. But now, here's something interesting. I'm just going to jump a quick bit ahead. That concludes the 8th halacha. The 9th goes and says, well, how come it says in the Torah, God's hand, God's eye, God's this and God's that? Rambam is going to conclude. It's all metaphorical language. I'll read that to you in a moment. But I want to tell you something now about an ancient Jewish teaching. which is called Shiur Kuma. If you will, the measurement of the stature. The most ancient recorded, what we can call Kabbalistic material that we have, outside the Bible, that is, of books like Ezekiel, Daniel, and the like, is a body of literature wherein which specific peoples, individuals, great and holy sages, would ascend, I guess we could call it ascend, some would call it descend, because it was actually a mental process of meditation, wherein which the individual, if you will, traveled in their minds, and were able to visualize the divine structure. And in this Shiur Koma literature, dating back possibly to Qumran, the Essenes, definitely to the days of the temple, and a number of hundred years after it, this body of literature is really weird. I don't know how else to describe it. Because they're speaking about physical measurements for what we call the body of God. And the implication, at least at surface value, is that there is such a physical body. The physical body of God in this literature would be approximately, oh, I think I once did a calculations and it worked out to be like 180 billion miles long, wide, whatever. So in essence, that for that body with which it speaks, the earth in its eye would be like a little minuscule little speck of dust. And all of us obviously a whole lot smaller. But yet, I haven't read any scholars who would disagree when stating that all of these measurements were actual metaphor and symbolic and never meant to be taken literally. However, in the commentaries to the Rambam, there are those who do challenge what the Rambam states here based upon this material. However, to be honest, Rambam is emphatic in a point which I think truly validates his Kabbalistic connection, even though, of course, that these words are written at a time when Kabbalistic materials were meant and destined to be concealed. Rambam recognized the nature of what we call archetype. Symbolic imageries and pictures. As this ninth halacha states, he quotes here, right? Being that God has no form or body, what does it mean when the Torah states below his feet, like in Exodus 24:10, written by the finger of God, Torah in Exodus 31:18, God's hand in Exodus 9:3, God's eyes, Genesis 38:7, God's ears, Numbers 11:1. He states here real clearly, Kol ha'kinui imhen, all of these symbols, right? He says here, they come, are used to relate to human thought processes which only know corporeal reality, because the Torah speaks in the language of mankind. Now this is very important. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, author of the Zohar, stated, very interesting, beautiful poetic statement that he made, that if all there was to the Torah was just the simple surface level stories that we read today, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai states, we could write a better Torah. Because if it's just stories, we could do better than that. But he says, being that the Torah contains within it such depths, such secret, the Torah, as we said, is clearly of extraterrestrial origins. It contains levels that have yet to be unlocked because we as human beings do not yet have keys, do not even have the consciousness to know what to look for and how to look for it. And yet it's all concealed in the Torah, which came from beyond. So the Torah speaks to us in a primitive form. Yes, that's right, primitive. Simply because we're primitive. In the Lashon, the language of our sages, we call this pshat. Simplistic basic meanings. I will interject here a Kabbalistic tradition that originally when the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, it did not have this pshat like Rambam is discussing now. But rather the original Torah, the Arizal states, was of the world of Atzilut, which means it did not have a surface level which needed to be penetrated because the inner essence was clearly and openly revealed. But yet the people couldn't handle it, as expressed by the sin of the golden calf. Now remember what the sin of the golden calf was. It wasn't that they built an idolatrous god and worshipped to it. No. The Pasukim clearly state that this was a representative image of the God of Israel, in complete violation of the concept that there must be this abstractness. Why must there be an abstract? Why can't we have images to represent God? The answer is real simple. Because once you take an image and you allow it to represent something, it literally congeals a force. And it puts something into something and by definition leaves something out of it. So you would say, this is the form of God and nothing else is. If we were to have an image and a vision of God, we would say, this is it and nothing else is. We would therefore creating a division. Because what is an image that can represent God? Want to give you the answer? I will. I'm sitting right now in a chair as I give you this class. The chair represents the image of God. My body, the human form, represents the image of God. Anything and everything in creation represents an image of God simply because the singularity which we call God is the ultimate source of everything. Not that everything is God, God forbid. That everything reflects by its nature its connection to the source. And therefore, Psalm 16, verse 8 states, I place God before me always. And in the Torah of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidut movement, he states, what does this verse mean? To see the singularity in all things. And therefore, there is no one form that we can pick and choose and say, this is the image of God, whereas nothing else is. Because once you've done that, you've created separation and division. You've given it a form and a structure. That, by definition, is called a body. And God has no form or semblance of form. And thus, when the Torah says, God heard, God spoke, God saw, all of this is symbolic metaphors to describe the individual prophet and his bond with, call it if you will, the absolute mind, the source of existence. It appeared in the individual prophet's mind in specific ways. We'll discuss all of that. We get into the issues of prophecy in later chapters. But nonetheless, the prophet had to learn to pierce through any image, any form, that would pop up into his mind. Or otherwise, he can be seduced by the form, and therefore become what we call a false prophet. Continuing to validate his ideas with this, Rambam writes, all these expressions are used to relate human thought processes, which only know the corporeal reality, because the Torah speaks the language of man, just like we said. And he says, they are only descriptive terms. For example, in Deuteronomy 32:41, he says, I will wet my lightning sword, to which Rambam questions, God has a sword? Gee, I wonder what kind is it. Is it a samurai sword? Is it a ninja sword? He says, does he need a sword to kill? Where do we ever see, anywhere in the history of any Judaic literature, where it says God came down from heaven and struck somebody with a sword? But yet God says, I'm going to strike him down with my sword. Obviously, this is metaphorical. It is symbolic. And we perform a crime, yes, a crime, a felony crime, if you will, when we misunderstand, misinterpret, and focus upon something being physical when it by all means should never be, and use therefore our physical image to fight other images, and therefore it turns into a tit for tat, my God's better than your God, my religion's better than yours, and Yeshu is going to fight Muhammad, who's going to fight the Buddha, who's going to fight Krishna, and on and on it goes. Because everybody has their image of God. We don't. We don't pray to Moshe Rabbeinu. And anybody who did would be considered an apostate and literally liable to death penalty. Big no-no by us. You can speak of great and holy rabbis and sages, but none of them, not even a prophet, are the embodiment of God. Only God is. Human beings are what we are. Human beings. And those who live and those who die are still human beings. That is by no means bad. On the contrary, it's the greatest good. Outside of our parameter, but we're obviously taught that man was created in the image of God. Therefore, that image, it's not a physical image. God doesn't look like us, that he has two eyes, ears, nose, and a mouth, even though we use such symbolic language both in the Bible and in later Kabbalistic literature. Nonetheless, it is symbolic. In Zoharic literature, in the writings of the Ari, oh, we get into great detail. Oh, we speak about the eyes and the ears and the nose and the mouth and the hairs. Yes, on the hairs themselves. We speak of all these ultimate little details. But a point that I tried to teach emphatically is like what Rambam writes here. Torah speaks in our language, our vernacular, to give us a construct of understanding. Even though Torah knows that when it says God's hand, God's eyes, God's sees, whatever, that we're only getting, if you will, 1% out of the whole thing. But nonetheless, heaven recognizes where we are at, if you will, as a race, what we can understand, and how we need to move on beyond our limitations. But that, of course, is the process of life. So, Rambam continues here, and he's going to offer us what he calls here some evidence. He states here that one prophet saw, that he saw the Holy One, blessed be he, clothed in white snow, quoting Daniel from 7:9 of Daniel. And yet he quotes Isaiah with regards to seeing, if you will, God with crimson garments from Basra. Now that's obviously, both cases, a metaphor. Continuing, he states, Moses, our teacher himself, envisioned God at the Red Sea as a mighty man waging war. Doesn't it say in the Shir Shel Yam, we recite it every day in our prayers, Amonai Ish Milchama, that God is a man of war. Is God really a man? No! Is God really all about war? Also no. But look at what it states in Kohelet, the wise words of Simon, of Shlomo HaMelech, where he states, for all things there is a purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to bless, a time to curse, a time to kill, a time to heal, on and on and on it goes with all these opposites, to ultimately show that they are all forces emanating from the singularity. And by our recognizing each one like a spoke in a wheel going into the center, we recognize the true nature of the Creator as much as we can. And with that, experience the reality. No form to be seen. There is no form to exist. Even God's holy name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, called the great unpronounceable name of God. It's not unpronounceable. It's not unpronounceable at all. You want to know how to pronounce God's name? I can tell you right now. It's easy. Same name that everybody in the days of the temple used. The reason why we say that God's name is unpronounceable is because the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is often combined with numerous different combinations of vowels to create numerous different forms. And from each form of letters and vowels, when resonated in proper harmonies of meditation, each express a different expression of reality emanating from the singularity. That's just the way that these things operate. So, continuing here, again, at one place God is experienced, if you will, like a mighty man of war. At another, he's like someone in prayer. And one time he's with white hair visualized, and another time with black hair visualized. Which is it? What's God's true hair color? Oh, curious minds want to know. Come on. There is no such thing. Don't even ask the question, all the more so try to argue the answer. It's ridiculous. The nature of a singularity defines and dictates. Like Rambam states, there is no image or form. All these are merely expressions of prophetic vision and imagery. And the truth of this concept cannot be grasped or comprehended by human thought. This is what the verse says in Job 11:7. Can you find the comprehension of God? Can you find the ultimate in the, of the Almighty? Now let me explain. I introduced the concept earlier called archetypes. Carl Jung, the psychologist, recognized that aside from our individual personalities and minds, in the unconscious there's like a collective strata in which all humanity is connected. They call this the collective unconscious. Mind you, it's through that level that we connect and talk to the angels. But in this collective unconscious, we share ideas, images, and pictures. Because at that fundamental level of how the human mind operates, what we experience as reality is not academic, intellectual, abstract philosophy, but rather simply pictures, images. Let me give you an example. Think, if you will, of a beautiful painting. Someone will look at the painting and analyze it. The types of paints used, the types of pigmentations used, how the colors were mixed, what type of canvas, how much of the paint is absorbed into the canvas, how much sits on top. In other words, intellectually analyzing the painting. Whereas another party will come and look at it as a breathtaking work of art. Not interested in the brushstrokes, but is interested in the message. If any of you have never seen true art, gosh, you go to a museum, you'll see this. To get an impression, a feeling. This is how, if you will, the heavenly dimension speaks to us. By a picture language, wherein which the imagery, regardless of our differences in culture, language, society, time and space, the images are relatively the same. Therefore, if you were to have a dream and you saw the rising sun, a full moon, roses in blossom, a spring day, the roaring oceans, all of these have a collective meaning that means pretty much the same for everybody. That's what we call the archetypes. One of these archetypes is the idea and the image of a higher being. And we experience this higher being as being in human form. And this is exactly what was going on in the ancient religions, which we call the idolatrous religions, wherein which the concept of a god, notice I didn't say the god, but a god, was of some kind of superhuman, half human, half god. The Torah condemns this.
the saying, of course, or again, limiting the construct and form into an archetype. Bad, wrong, contradictory to everything, and where that psychologically leads to. So then, what is experienced? Again, I turn to psychology. Carl Jung referred to this experience as a noumenostic experience. And he states that our own inner selves, our own unconscious self, is so disconnected from us, so removed, that if we were to experience it, that it somehow connect with our deepest and innermost self, that the image of that connection would be reflected as some higher being, which we therefore call God. And it is nothing other than a reflection of our own inner selves. In many religious circles today, not so much in Judaism, but other religions, people believe themselves to be prophets. Not that they've ever had any training in prophecy or the like, they just believe they hear God's voice. And I hear many people say, yeah, the Lord told me. That's right, the Lord told me this, the Lord told me that. The Lord isn't telling anybody anything. Ultimately, what a person is doing in prayer is getting into a meditative state of mind and connecting to their own inner selves and are having a noumenostic experience. This is not a connection to the singularity, the primordial existence. And to confuse the two violates the law, you shall have no other gods upon God's face, violates the law of idolatry. And this is why we proclaim again and again, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Singularity, no form, no image, nothing construct and concrete into this and not that. Because ultimately, the truth is in everything. There is no separation between good and evil. God is the author of them both. Unlike in the Christian Mithraic traditions, Zoroastrian too, wherein which you have the good and evil duking it out with one another. No, you don't. No, you don't. Satan is God's servant, the Zohar teaches us. We see that clearly in the book of Job. He comes and hangs out with the sons of God. He enters in. God talks to him. Ultimate singularity. It is probably one of the most fundamental and powerful lessons of our entire Torah. And I pray that I've done some justice to explain its validity and importance for us to recognize that ultimately everything comes from the source. We have a concept in our Torah world. We call it Hashgacha Pratit. Big argument amongst the philosophers and theologians. Most will want to agree and state, okay, God created the universe in the beginning. Then what? Party A says, okay, then he left, said you're up to your own devices. Party B states, no. Being that everything is emanating from the singularity, that's still connected to the singularity, instead of acting in chaos, that even the chaos has a purpose and a meaning to rise order, and that we have been created to be the ones to participate in the great experiment of existence, to achieve a goal of the creation of unity, the creation of order. And we do this by applying the concept of the singularity, not by contradicting it. The ultimate goal, the ultimate purpose. We call this Hashgacha Pratit, divine influence, if you will, divine guidance in each and every single detail of life. Because ultimately that's where God is. And everything has a meaning. That's the meaning of what we learned earlier, psychologically calling it synchronicity. Our job is to look for meaning, for purpose. To peel back the veils of illusion in our world and to endeavor to see the truth. And ultimately, like we learned in our last lesson, we should draw the conclusion, as the Torah verse states, Ein od milivado. Nothing else other than Him. And remember, God is not a him or her. Those are metaphorical terms. We described them already in our previous lesson. Ein od milivado. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. This is what Torah is. This is what Israel is. This is our truth. This is only validated by our scientific understandings of reality. Ultimately, we should endeavor to see through the veils of diversity, complexity, and chaos to bring order. On that note, Be'ezrat Hashem, let's conclude tonight's shiur, and we will pick up more about this idea of how and why God expresses and reveals Himself into creation. We will conclude Be'ezrat Hashem, God be willing, these last three laws of the first chapter of the Yesodei Torah. And within this lesson, I pray, God be willing, we're going to talk about a Kabbalistic concept called the Sefirot. God be willing for our next class. Baruch Adonai L'Olam. Amen.